We know where Hoffa is. Yep. We know where Hoffa is buried. We'll get to that later. You know, first, we have to do our news that we do specifically. And, you know, I know you're driving up north, whatever you may do, be doing. Happy 4th of July. But the question is, the Detroit mayor's race, because that's going to affect us all, right? So did Solomon Kinloch really live in a low rent flop? The pastor has a beautiful estate in the burbs, but to meet the Detroit mayor residency requirement, he claims to have been clout surfing in the city. And we're going to bring you the visual evidence and the location of Jimmy Hoffa's corpse in a little bit. But first, there is a heavenly estate in the far reaches of North Oakland County that boasts 5 bedrooms, 4 baths, and a goodnight pool. This sumptuous 5,177 square foot grotto has an estimated value of 1.6 million large. For the past 10 years, it has been the home of Solomon Kinloch Jr., senior pastor of Triumph Church. Triumph is a mega worship complex with seven locations across metropolitan Detroit, advertising 6 ways to donate. Kinloch's Manor is located in Oakland Township in a quiet neighborhood, the type where everyone seems to die of boredom. The mailboxes are replicas of the homes themselves, the grounds are immaculately manicured, and the commute to Detroit City Hall is a mere 50 minutes with light traffic and no road construction. Not too bad when Jesus is your co-pilot, but not so good when you're running to be Detroit's next mayor. Kinloch is a nice guy, I do not doubt. A man of faith and good deeds, it is said. But with its current financial straits, Detroit needs a mayor with a certain worldly sophistication, one who understands municipal finance, union negotiations, and pension obligations. Besides, Detroit deserves a guy who actually lives in the city. Now, Kinloch claims that he does live in Detroit and has done so of March of last year. According to the city charter, candidates for municipal office must have lived in the city for at least 1 year before filing paperwork. So the question's simple enough. Where does the pastor lay his head? Kinloch has had 4 domiciles in the past year, having wandered more than Moses himself. There's the manor in Oakland County for one, and another 3 addresses in the city. Last March, Kinloch supposedly left his wife and child to fend for themselves all the way up there in Oakland County while he registered his new living quarters at a pay-as-you-go dump on Michigan Avenue, popular with European backpackers. Kinloch apparently stayed on the 9th floor, which sports code locks on the doors, paint falling off the walls, and stains on the carpet. His room was located near the garbage chute. So there's that. 10 weeks later, Kinloch moved in with his brother in an apartment on Gratiot Avenue near Greektown. He allegedly stayed there for 6 months, according to the voter registration records. One wonders which brother did the shopping and which cleaned the toilets. During this time, Kinloch's wife moved into the same building as Kinloch and his brother, but into a different unit. Kinloch did not change his address to his wife's new apartment for another 2 months, according to the records. Why? Maybe he really liked his brother's kitchen cacciatore. I don't know. Now, this from the campaign. Solomon Kinloch has a valid license. His Detroit address was verified when he filed to run for mayor. He voted in the 2024 election at his Detroit polling location using the current address. Now, the problem with that statement is that Kinloch has a new current address. No one in his camp, it seems, can get the story straight. There's a whiff of dishonesty about the whole thing, Minister. It's not too much to ask a mayor to know his own zip code and to actually want to live among the people he represents. Can I get an amen?
Amen.
Amen. Roll it.
Live from downtown Detroit. It's the No Bullshit News Hour with my main man, Charlie LaDuff and Karen Dubitz.
Just breaking news. Double or bullshit.
Coffee cup's leaking. I mean the Pepsi. Come on down to American Coney Island. All Pepsi product. I'm just trying to move product. Do not put hot coffee in your Pepsi cup. Ugh. That's what we learned today. Now, we know where Jimmy Hoffa is, but I'm not going to tell you yet. I have to finish with this whole Detroit mayor mess. Okay, so Mary Sheffield, city council president, leads in all the polls. But ML Elric, friend of the show, friend of mine,
yeah,
top notch, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter. Oh, he's been whooping that ass, man. So let's see here. She says she's not taking money from billionaires or PACs. Lie. Turns out her billboards got shady characters attached to them. One guy tried to shake down Monica Conyers so he could get a titty club in the city. And then there's guys wrapped up in car theft and the towing mob contract shit. It's all really fucking weird, right? Then we got, if you guys watch the debates, the No Bullshit News Hour mayoral debates, Jonathan Barlow, the guy that got up, act like tough guy and took off his jacket, really made a name for himself and went viral this week for bitch slapping a chick with a phone at 2 a.m. with a drink in his hand. Said he was, what was he doing? Parking cars?
Yeah, that's what he said.
With a drink in your hand.
At 2 a.m. Yeah, parking cars, helping out the community all at 2 a.m.
I don't know. See, that's why we had to start out with the Detroit mayor shit, because apparently everybody in America is into the Detroit mayor shit, because this thing got like 3-4 million views already. Let's roll it. Look at him. God, he looks stone as shit. Oh, roll it again, dude. Oh, my God. What the fuck is he on? Wow, put that on a billboard, Mary. Holy smokes. Let's show it again. Oh my God, it looked like Bela Lugosi, this motherfucker. Hold on a second. It's, oh my God, it's Count Blackula. What the fuck is going on? Woo. Well, it was a short, beautiful career. One more time.
So great. Man. What is he thinking?
That's what he looked like when he took his jacket off at the debate.
Yeah, and rolled up his sleeves, yeah.
So there's that. All right, so, you know, to be fair, here's the visual. Now, if you're driving, don't watch this, because traffic's heavy on 75. If you're driving, you can watch this later. It's a pretty good video. Actually, it's an excellent video, and it's edited by Ken Beck, partner at the Michigan Enjoyer. And you can find that on my social media accounts, Charla Duff, YouTube, all that, but and we'll repost it tomorrow. But let's take a look at the saga of Jonathan Moses Jr. Kinlock.
This estate is owned by Triumph Megachurch Pastor Solomon Kinlock.
If you are in anything that Jesus is not in, then you ought to want to get yourself out of it.
He wants to be Detroit's next mayor, but he hasn't lived in the city in decades. And why would he? It's really nice up here. The mailbox looked like little houses, and the grass is manicured
one knuckle high.
The irony's not lost on the gardeners.
Estar el mayor de Detroit, pero él vive aquí. Oh. It's ridiculous, eh?
It's one of those tasteful Tony suburbs where no one gets shot, but people are dying to move in.
No one home. Maybe we should check his Detroit addresses.
The pastor's estate is closer to Flint than to Detroit City Hall. And if he does live up here, then the commute is going to be 50 minutes, barring traffic and construction. And in Michigan, there's always construction. But the minister insists he does live in Detroit. To beat the residency deadline last year, Kinlock claims he moved into this pay-as-you-go dump on Michigan Avenue.
So apparently he stayed here at this half-built scuzz hotel right near the elevator. Pastor of the megachurch. 10 weeks. Here. Near the trash chute. So that's handy.
Meanwhile, the pastor left his wife and kid way up there in the burbs. The Reverend stayed at the flop house for 3 months, and then he claims he moved in with his brother here for the next 6 months. I wonder which guy did the shopping and which guy cleaned the toilets. Then, Kinlock's wife moved into the same building in December, but the pastor didn't change address until February. The irony's not lost on the security guard.
That's what the gardener said.
Oh, there's a bunch of Kinlocks.
Calling, please hold.
The mailbox is full and cannot accept any messages at this time. Goodbye.
That would be weird. You're living here and someone came to see you and there's no messages.
So to sum it up, Pastor Kinlock has 7 churches in Metro Detroit, 6 ways to donate, and 4 different addresses. People are laughing because they all get the joke.
Where do you live, Pastor? Trey would like to know.
And a lawsuit's coming, too.
That's a great piece. Love it.
Oh, my God. This is so fun. And, you know, like, there's another guy, Todd Perkins, who seems most reasonable, tied in, Ivy League educated, born on the north side of Detroit, actually writes the municipal law in the city. And the money, the power that be, Mackinac, the regional conference, he wasn't invited. He wasn't invited to this Cranes thing. He wasn't invited to Channel 4's boring shit-a-palooza of a thing. But when he was at ours, he impressed.
Mm-hmm. You know? I thought he was good. I like him.
I don't know why they can't make room in their boring programs for the for this guy again. Put up Barlow. I'd invite this guy anytime, man. Just for the ratings. Go ahead. $3 million. Okay. Now the primary election is early August. Please vote and vote often, Detroit. Now let's Jimmy Hoffa. I think we know where Jimmy Hoffa is. Let me bring into the program, old friend of the show, true crime writer, one of the best in the country, board member of the Mob Museum in Vegas, and a guy who knows all things P. Diddy.
All Scott
Bernstein.
Crime.
What's up, brother? What's up, Scott?
Thanks for having me, Charlie. I'm your biggest fan, man. You're really an inspiration, man. What you've been able to do with this podcast, and you were a pioneer, you and you guys like Drew Lane, and that really understood that you didn't need mainstream media anymore. You could do your own thing, go direct to consumer, and it's really, you know, inspired me and got me off and running on my own brand. So I owe a debt to you and Drew, who kind of showed me that this was the way to go.
I'll let him know. Does Drew know you?
Yeah, I know Drew. That's how I know. That's how I know. Bill.
What's my name? It's all right.
Well, listen. Nothing's planned here. It was the other night I get home and it's basically, dude, we know where Hoffa is.
We know where his Hoffa is. We know who killed him, and we're gonna tell everybody.
Whoa.
Okay, tell us.
So I'm.
Wait a minute. First of all.
Yeah.
A word from our sponsors.
I'm Grace Karros, and I'm third generation of American Coney Island. People say Detroit's a comeback city. I say, where you been? We've been here for over 100 years. My family's been here on the same corner, serving our famous proprietary American Coney Island hot dog. So like always, we're keeping things fresh, updated, and new. We'd love to have you come downtown and visit us, but if you can't, you can always go to AmericanConeyIsland.com, order a Coney kit, get it delivered fresh right to your door.
This message of uplift is brought to you by business and personal wealth advisor Luke Nowacki, who reminds you that what does it profit a man to gain the whole world but never enter the kingdom of God? But while you're waiting, Nowacki wants you to remember that overreaction is not a sound financial strategy. So call Luke Nowacki at 248-663-4748 for sound financial advice.
Well, you know, when it rains, the power goes out. And when the power goes out, the internet goes out. When the internet goes out, I call my friend Matt and Bernie at XG Service Group. Look at Bernie here on his hands and knees, giving it everything he's got. Look at that man crack. So busy, he forgot to wear a belt. There's Matt right there getting the board together. That's 734-245-4100 if you need Matt and Bernie to come take care of your voice over internet, your security cameras, off-campus access control, Wi-Fi, and cameras for homes and business. They'll design it for you. You got restaurants, they do drive-through systems, railroad cameras for public safety, total wireless camera systems for your home and business. Yeah, that's right. Call XG Services at 734-245-4100.
Are you an aging senior wondering where you'll end up? Are you a son or a daughter wishing your mom or dad lived closer to home? Are you a caregiver with good heart and good character, but you feel stuck in a dead-end job? Are you a social entrepreneur looking for a safe real estate investment within a fast-growing market? Well, consider contacting Archangel Senior Management. Archangel offers a solution and a vision to compete with big corporate senior living communities. Call Archangel at 989-614-0316.
So where were we?
You know, we're talking about how it's 50 years since Jimmy Hoffa disappeared, and we're finally going to put a bow on this thing and tell everybody exactly what happened and who did it and where the body is.
Okay, so... Might as well. Are you going to tell us? Because I know you're doing like a cabaret.
So I can tease it a little bit, but I can't.
Well, you're
really...
doing a cabaret evening.
Yeah. Somewhere. So July 23rd out at Macomb Community College, 7 to 9.
Nothing but class. Community. So he's underneath Macomb Community College.
Yeah, it's at South Campus. It's in their performing arts auditorium. We're hoping to get about 500 people out there, and then we're hoping to replicate the event if this first one goes well. So it's going to be a 90-minute multimedia presentation, never before seen video, never before seen photos, all directly from FBI archives. I'm doing it along with a former Detroit mobster named Novi Toko and a former
Toko family.
Yep, okay. The Toko Zerli crime family, and then with a retired federal prosecutor, Rick Convertino. The three of us have come to a consensus. We kind of hit it from, we don't kind of, we hit it from three different angles, from a research angle, investigative angle, which I've been doing for 20 years. We hit it from the actual crime family that did the deed, which Novi Toko represents. And then we hit it from an investigative angle from the government who's been looking into this for 50 years. And shout out to Rick Convertino, who's become a good friend of mine. He was on top of this before anybody. He, and again, I don't want to give away what we're going to be talking about on July 23rd, but he nailed this down back in 1993, and he actually brought it to me several years after that. I didn't dismiss it, but I definitely didn't fully co-sign it. And now, you know, almost over 30 years later, what he came forward with back in the 90s, which was dismissed by the federal government, is now the standing theory of the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office.
So Convertino, being a Detroit-based federal prosecutor, yep, might know a few things. He gives it to you, and then over the decades, you're doing independent verification,
yes,
freedom of information, FBI archives, etc.
Interviewing. I interviewed almost, I would say, 95% of all the agents that worked the case from 1975 through 2005. I've interviewed 30 retired FBI agents, numerous people on the street, including at least two people that were involved in the conspiracy, according to the FBI, I was able to interview.
And Toko, the rat, is the family going to whack him?
Well, he's been back here now for 10 years out of witness protection. He waited until Jack Toko died. Jack Toko was the godfather, the one that did want to kill him. And Jack Toko died in 2015 in the summer.
Why did he want to kill him?
Because Novi became the first ever member of the crime family to turn government cooperator.
Who'd he turn on, the family?
He turned on the entire family, yes. Oh. But just to be, I want to be very clear. Now, yes, Novi was a cooperator, but his cooperation was considerably...
You know where the word cooperator comes from? It's Latin. Translates loosely into rat. Rat Fink, to be specific.
But
no offense to the guy, you know.
Well, I just want people to know that, you know, his cooperation was a lot different than most mobsters' cooperation. He never testified in a trial. He never wore a wire. He simply debriefed for a lesser sentence. So they never used him as a, you know, as an instrument to go after
other
people.
So we got you. By the way, like, I've got your books, man.
Thank you.
Just like the best crime writing. And it's true. It's true crime.
It's all true crime.
Right? Yeah. It's excellent.
And it all started with this. 20 years ago, it all started with Hoffa. I got a book deal when I was 28, 29 years old. I was going to write about the history of the Detroit Mafia. And when you're going to dive into the deep end of writing about the history of Detroit Mafia, the first thing you're going to hit is Jimmy Hoffa. And so I've been on top of this for 20 years. I'd like to consider myself the preeminent expert in the world on this. And
I would say you are now.
And I'm eager to let everybody know and have them come out and experience this.
Where do they get the tickets? Where do we
You can get OGMediaEvents.com.
OGMediaEvents.com.
And they're $30 a pop.
Okay.
So, you know, for
two serving people, some Danish.
Yeah, we'll have some you know, some refreshments. And you're going to come out and you're going to get, you know,
some meatballs and lead sandwiches.
You're going to get answers to questions that have been percolating for a half century.
All right. Enough of this bullshit. Give me something specific. People are driving right now. They want to know where the fuck Hoffa is.
So I will say this.
Wait, is he in state?
Yes. He never left the state.
He never left the state.
Never left the state.
The Tri-County region.
Yes.
Okay. Well, let's do 20 questions. Okay.
And, you know, I will say, you know, I'll give little teases here and there.
Okay.
I will say that the Detroit Mafia had ownership and control of three separate sanitation companies that had incinerators at that time. I will say that one of them burned down in a suspicious arson fire in the months after Jimmy Hoffa disappeared. And I will say that the killer is a name that has never really surfaced publicly. You know, you've heard of, if you've been following this case, you've heard the names Tony Giacalone, Tony Provenzano, over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Frank Sheeran more recently, which we can go into that. I mean, that's the con from the grave, man. The movie The Irishman, the $200 million Netflix, mm-hmm. Marty Scorsese, Robert De Niro. I mean, that is just blasphemy. I mean, the falsehoods that were...
You mean it's fake?
Facilitated in that movie. And it's a shame because it's coming from Marty Scorsese, people are, you know, people think it's the gospel. And in reality, nothing that you saw in that movie actually happened. But the killer is somebody that has not really been a name that people would recognize unless you're a Detroit mobster.
The name was floating, though. Like
the name really has not been floating until the last 10 years when a top echelon FBI informant came forward with the name. And the name had been out there in the investigation since Convertino had brought it into the conversation in the early 90s. In the early 90s. But it didn't really take the weight on in terms of the FBI saying, okay, this has merit.
Did Convertino talk to was told about this and talk to this guy?
Yeah, so he was prosecuting this guy. And he got this guy on a wire.
And then
on the wire he confessed. The FBI back in the early 90s
that
thought,
tape still exists?
Yeah. We're gonna
have it?
Yeah, we're gonna be showing it.
I was like, you know, I don't doubt you,
Time, just because there's been so many people that have come forward with theories and tips, and there have been a lot of real tough mob guys that have admitted to some role in this that they're just bragging, right? It's not true. They're trying to use it as currency.
Why would we think this is any different?
Well, at the time, that's what it was thought to be.
Okay.
When Rick Convertino kind of uncovered this 30 years ago. But in the years since, you've had a number of confidential informants that have been deemed of high value that would know or would have good information on this, and they've all come forward and corroborated this. And then I want to shout out Professor Goldsmith at Harvard, who wrote a book about Chucky O'Brien, who was his stepdad. And in that book, he also identifies this person, or he identifies him without mentioning the name, but explains about who this guy is.
So,
and he was a Detroit mobster that was of quite you know, a lot of presence and a lot of juice, a lot of power. He died.
The hitman.
He died recently, and he was a guy that you know, his reputation preceded him in certain areas of the city where people knew what the mob was. For people that don't know what the mob is and
he was the inside guy.
He was a very under the radar major player.
Interesting. So once you reveal this, we're all going to be able to find out who this guy is.
Yes.
Okay. He's
and I was able to actually interview him before he passed. And I was trying to broker a...
Did you suspect? Did you know at this time? At that time, that he was the guy?
I had come around to that theory.
Okay. You asked him point blank.
Right. And I was trying to set up an interview with NBC that was almost worked out. That was going to be on NBC News to commemorate the 45th year anniversary. This would have been in 2020, but it didn't happen. He got sick. What did he say? He didn't admit it, but he talked around the issue and got a kick out of it. And you could kind of tell that he was
toying,
admitting it without admitting it.
Do you have that on tape?
No.
Okay. That's part of like, you will give that to your audience, your recollection of the conversation.
Yes.
And you're trying to like save it. So, you know, my audience doesn't want to buy tickets.
Right.
Where do they, I'm going to come to this fucking thing.
OGmediaEvents.com. And then my company is OG Media. And we're going to start doing a slate of live events. We're going to start off with Hoffa, but then we're going to move on to other subjects. The Purple Gang, White Boy Rick, Black Mafia Family.
Who gives a fuck? I mean, it's Hoffa, dude. I don't care about...
I'm just saying that the OG Media eventually,
I see.
After we do our Hoffa event for the next year,
series,
we're
yes.
gonna do a we're gonna do a year of Hoffa, and then we're gonna start branching off and doing other types of kind of theme events based around iconic Detroit crime.
Can you count me?
Yes, you're rolling out the red carpet.
Send a car.
Yeah.
Dinner.
Yeah. Okay, for sure.
July 23rd.
It's at the South Campus, not South on Hall Campus. Road. So 12 and Hayes. I'm really excited to share some of the archival that nobody's ever seen before. You're going to get video and...
How do you kill him? You're gonna get video, you're going to get pictures.
You're
going to
get video, you're going to get
you're
photos.
You're going to get projections of documents right. in the FBI file that
yes.
you've never seen.
Yes.
You're going to get Toko to Rat's recollection of
yes.
Convertina. Dude, it sounds great. I'm not joking around.
No, I'm really excited about it. And then as we continue, hopefully to continue to do them, we might add some more people to the stage, some retired FBI agents, maybe some other retired gangsters, some more prosecutors. We're going to mix it up. So we have a lot of people that are eager to be a part of this. I think it's important. I don't know what the FBI plans to do this year on July 30th. I've been kind of campaigning
it's
over the last 50
years
couple,
at the end of this month. Huh?
Right. So it's 50 years. I've been campaigning, and I use that term loosely. But for the last couple of years, I've been out there saying the FBI should hold a press conference on July 30th, 2025, and close the investigation officially. And
have you gone to them with what you have?
Yeah, they all know. I know all of them. They all know. I know them. They know me. I know exactly what they believe. That's part of what this is going to be.
Do they believe it?
Yeah, well, I'm going to be telling people what the FBI... I mean, this is what the FBI thinks. So, whether the FBI has a press conference on July 30th or not...
The FBI believes your theory is correct.
Yeah, yes.
Really?
Yes. So I don't know if they're going to hold a press conference or not. I know that this is very personal for them. My sense right now is they're not going to close the investigation. They're going to keep it open. You got to remember, this is something, it's not just been a half century of fruitless searches. We're talking tens of millions of dollars, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars over a half century of resources being put out to try to solve this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the dig back in 20 years ago in 2006 at the ranch down in, it's like at the border of Commerce and Milford, of Milford and Commerce, called Hidden, it was called Hidden Dreams Ranch. That cost $7 million. They were there for two weeks, $7 million. So, I mean, these are not cheap endeavors.
Exactly.
So you've put a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of energy into it. It's very personal. So
they put him in a trash incinerator, mob-owned trash incinerator in Detroit. How'd they whack him?
Definitely possible. I think that's really the biggest question. I think 99% of this is known by myself, by the people that I'm doing this event with, by the FBI. But I think there is a small slice that we don't know. And I think one of the things that we don't know for sure, and we're going to discuss this on our panel, is how he was killed. I think there are three main possibilities: that he was shot to death, that he was strangled to death, and that he was bludgeoned to death. And I will say from my research, and again, I've talked to dozens of people that were either involved in the investigative side of this or the criminal side of this, and I've heard from really good sourcing all three things.
Beat him up a little, strangle him a little, yeah, and shot him. Jeez. And put him in a pan, threw some pineapple on him, and stuck him in the oven.
Yeah, one. I'll throw out.
Detroit style.
I'll give one anecdote that I heard from a really good source. And they said that this was a bloodletting that was done in front of a group of mob leaders, that there were so many people that were upset with him, that there were mob bosses that wanted to watch his execution, and that it was a...
That's weird.
That there was a hit team of a dozen guys that when he walked into the place where they killed him, they jumped him, eventually strangled him to death, and the...
Was that the Fox and Hound? Is that what it's called?
No.
Red Fox?
Red.
They kidnapped him from the Red Fox.
The Red Fox.
At 15 and Telegraph. And they took him to a residence somewhat nearby. I have a number of theories of which residence they took him to. But the theory that I heard from somebody...
Could it have been in Oakland Township?
Well, they dug up in Oakland Township in 2013.
When they had taken...
Adams and Buell.
When they were building the minister's pool?
Right by the minister Kinloch's estate. This is an interesting quote from somebody that allegedly was there, and they said it was like a rodeo.
Really?
That they had to ride him like a bull down to the ground, and they strangled him, and there was like six guys that were jumping on top of him, and there were some other mob leaders there to watch. Now, it seems unlikely, but I will say that there is a precedent, not necessarily in the 70s, but in the 40s and 50s, there were some documented mob murders where the leaders of the mob were present when people were killed.
Okay, do this because, you know, next week, folks, I was gonna give you my estimation of the big, beautiful bill and that stuff. I had a long talk with, you know, former head of the equity desk of big Wall Street firms yesterday, figured some stuff out, but we're driving right now. It's 4th of July, and this is really interesting. So next week, we're back to economics and your well-being, but would you mind just explaining the saga
of
Jimmy Hoffa and what happened, where he came, you know, just...
Yeah.
Let me set it up now. We're all driving. Just a minute. I'm driving. I don't know why everybody drives up to Traverse City. It's too fucking far. You know what I mean? It's too far.
Or
across the state. I go to the Thumb. You know, nice and rednecky, undeveloped, less than 100 miles from
Cross Lex.
Yeah, exactly, man. So now we're driving. Jimmy Hoffa, the life. Scott Bernstein, the author. Roll it.
So Hoffa was spent his early years in Indiana on a farm. His dad passed away, and his mom moved them up to Detroit. And as a young man, you know, as a teenager in his early 20s,
what year was this?
So he was born in 1913.
So it's the Roaring 20s.
So the 20s comes up here.
Or maybe just when the Depression hits.
Yeah, and you know, is a, you know, scrappy, tough as nails kind of street kid. There's a famous picture of him as a teenager throwing dice on a street corner. And then he becomes a rising star in the labor union world. From the time he was like 18 or 19, he organizes what became a famous labor strike on the docks of Kroger, known as the Strawberry Strike, where young men that were unloading produce on the dock were not being treated very well, weren't being paid very well. And he organized a strike. It got a lot of news coverage. He was fired by Kroger after organizing the strike and immediately was recruited by the Teamsters and kind of put on the fast track. made his way up, became the youngest member on their executive committee. I think he was in his 30s, became vice president, and then became president in 1957.
I could pause you there. This, you might not know, Matty Maroon, the trucking magnate,
yes,
told me this. He was very close with Hoffa. The Maroon service station was next to the Teamsters headquarters.
Yeah, 299.
That Jimmy Hoffa is the guy that came up and perfected the chain link method of organizing.
Yeah.
Which is, if you don't join the Teamsters, we're going to put a fucking chain through your windshield.
Well, Jimmy Hoffa was like half gangster, half, you know, Teamster boss. So, I mean, he wasn't a stuffy boardroom type. He was a street guy that got put into the boardroom by the mob,
okay,
to run the boardroom for the mob. And, you know, he grew that union to, you know, mammoth heights. I mean, this was the most powerful union in the world, was represented, you know, truck drivers around the globe, cartage haulers, and he really became the face of the American working man.
Could I interrupt you again?
Yeah.
They had their fingers in everything. And remember the Detroit race course?
Yeah.
That was a Teamster track. My grandfather was the morning odds maker.
Yep.
And there's a picture somewhere in the Free Press when they're on strike. There's Hoffa and my grandpa, right, at the fence.
And the Detroit mob owned Hazel Park.
Yeah. And I said to my mom, I said, Mom, Grandpa, is it Jimmy Hoffa? And she says, your grandfather was the most elegant man I've ever met. And I go, I don't doubt it, but he was a fucking mobster, Mom.
Yeah, not Hazel Park, the city, Hazel Park racetrack.
Yes.
Which was a college graduation present in 1949 for the two mob princes, Jack Tocco and Tony Zerilli, whose dads were the founding fathers of the mafia here, Black Bill Tocco and Joe Zerilli. When their sons graduated from the University of Detroit and got business degrees, they were given the Hazel Park racetrack.
Wow.
And these were the people that were involved in conspiracy to kill Jimmy Hoffa. So it's all connected.
Yeah. And the nephew's back, the favorite son.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
It's unbelievable. Okay. So Hoffa, 50s, pensions.
So, right.
Kennedys,
so,
what's going on?
So he becomes president, and the Teamsters just get more powerful by the second. There's the Central States Pension Fund, which is the golden goose that lays the golden eggs. And mobsters from around the country and mob associates, mob affiliates could go to the pension fund and get very low interest loans of astronomical amounts of money to build businesses.
Casinos
to
then in Vegas?
Build businesses to then steal from. Now, the most well-known of these investments was Las Vegas. All of kind of old Vegas, and then this kind of the second iteration of Vegas, were all built by the mob using Teamster Fund pension money. And then they were all fleeced. So they got in, they got out. It was about a, you know, 30, 40 year thing. They're not there anymore. It's very, you know, Vegas is very corporate right now.
Yeah.
But from the late 40s into the 90s, I mean, this was, you know, the mob ran Vegas because they controlled all of the hotel casinos, which they had either purchased or actually built with Teamster pension fund money. So, and then as a result, you know, you had this, you know, these access points where Hoffa not just, you know, give you access to the pension fund, but could give you access to Teamster jobs and contracts. And I think one of the things, or I would say two of the things that, two of the biggest things that people don't know about Jimmy Hoffa is A, at the end of his life, he was a confidential informant for the FBI, and one of the reasons he got killed. And B, he was one of America's largest narcotics traffickers. He was in bed with the mob, specifically the Detroit guys, and using his trucking empire to move drugs across the country that were coming in from Europe and coming through the border in Canada.
Did he have connections to Max Fisher?
I'm not sure about the connections to Fisher. I know that when you start doing, you know, drill downs into some of this stuff, especially in a different era, all of the big wigs were kind of rubbing elbows.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, I would say social structures, the economy, in the sense that back then, if we want to, I know I'm all over the place here, but back then all the Detroit athletes, and every team was hanging out with the mob guys because they were of, they were the ones that, you know, had money. The gangsters are the only ones that had the money to do the things that the athletes were doing. Now there's such a huge, you know, the athletes now make so much money. Back then, guys that were playing professional football and professional baseball had to work like jobs in the off season. Now, you know, you're making $200 million. There's no real reason for you to be interacting with anybody, let alone a mob guy.
Right.
But back then they were running in the same, a lot of the same social circles. But, so Hoffa, it is growing the union. They're building Vegas. They're putting people into jobs around the country. They're moving drugs. And, you know, you said it, you know, the government, Bobby Kennedy, they wanted to take him down. And the, you know, there was quite the, I don't know if it's, I guess it's irony. It's rich in irony where the mob got Kennedy, John Kennedy elected. And then you would think conventional wisdom says, well, the mob gets you elected, you're going to go easy on the mob. But it went the other direction. The mob got Kennedy elected and he immediately went after the mob. And going after the mob at that point was going after the Teamsters, and Hoffa was in the crosshairs, and they eventually nailed Hoffa on a jury tampering fraud bribery case out of Nashville. And he goes to prison in 1967, and he's supposed to go away for 12 years or 12 to 15 years. And the mob, the Teamsters make a deal with the White House and Richard Nixon to get Hoffa out early, and they get a commutation in return for giving Nixon labor support for the 72 presidential election. And Hoffa, instead of coming out in 1981 or 82, comes out at Christmas 1971. So he'd been in for about 4.5 years, and he comes out, you know, hits the ground running and has only one thing on his mind, and that is to reclaim the Teamsters presidency. Because when he was in prison, he had to give it up in order for the commutation to come through. Nixon said, you gotta pass it on to your vice president. Maybe you can get it back later, but I can't commute you while you're still president. So he gives it.
So he was president while in prison?
He was a president while in prison. So
rank and file elects Jimmy Hoffa as president while he's serving a federal
bid. They loved him. I mean, he was... He would have been reelected in 76, which was part of the problem.
Okay.
So he's replaced by Frank Fitzsimmons, who was his right-hand man, his vice president, a Detroit guy, Irish, very loyal, well, appeared to be very loyal. And he was loyal, but at the end of the day, he wasn't loyal to Hoffa. He was loyal to the mob. And Fitzsimmons was a lapdog. I mean, Hoffa was a pit bull. Fitzsimmons was a lapdog. Hoffa was ferocious. Fitzsimmons was meek. And after a couple years of dealing with Fitzsimmons, the mob said, we'd rather deal with this guy than the headache that Jimmy Hoffa is. Because at that point, Hoffa's ego was totally out of control. He had really gotten kind of too big for his britches, wasn't taking orders, wanted, you know, bigger shares of things and more say in things, and thought he was bigger than the people that had put him in there. And he was told, you're not getting the union back. And this drove Hoffa crazy because that's all he really cared about. This was his baby. And so when he got off parole restrictions in the end of 73, he goes on a media tour. Goes on 60 Minutes, goes on with Walter Cronkite. And the media tour is telling everybody, I'm coming back. I'm going to reclaim the presidency in the 76 election. And when I get in, all these people that are trying to keep me out, meaning the mob, I'm going to clean the union up and I'm going to rid it of all mob influence, which means they're going to get their access to the pension fund cut off.
Right.
And he's going around, you know, in these national television appearances, threatening very powerful, dangerous mafia figures. So in the year leading up to his disappearance,
I mean, the whole mob, that's like Chicago,
everybody, he's Kansas not just City, right. He's New not York, just threatening Detroit. He's the threatening New York, Chicago, Philadelphia. Yeah.
Wow.
And I would say the only thing the movie The Irishman got right was Pacino's portrayal of Hoffa. I thought it did a good job of displaying how his hubris got him killed. Like, he just didn't. He thought he was above it all, and that these people, even though they were dangerous, even though they had put me in power, even though they had killed all these people that I know about, they're not going to kill me.
So in 75, it looks like he's going to win it.
So in 75, he's positioned to not just win, but win in a landslide.
Okay.
I mean, he was going to sweep back into power. And in the, let's say, the 8-9 months preceding his murder, there was a goon squad that was created by the Teamsters and the mob of guys that had once been loyal to Hoffa and had once been his muscle, guys that he would dispatch if he needed to lean on somebody. Well, then they were basically told to stop being a trucker, and now your job for the next year is to intimidate and coerce Hoffa and his people into not running. And so there was a series of beatings and firebombings and shootings that really hit a crescendo July 10th, which was 20 days before Hoffa disappeared on July 30th. And the Fitzsimmons and his son had their car blown up in the parking lot at Nemo's, which is
at Nemo's.
Still a bar
right there,
right down the street, Michigan Avenue.
Car bombing.
Yes. Yeah. So they bombed Fitzsimmons' car.
I tell you what, I just get like tired of being here all these years because it's a hard town.
Yeah.
And you think you know it all.
Right.
And you don't know half of it, man. Okay.
The perception is that Hoffa has gone so far off the reservation that he's putting car bombs in the automobile of his
It was Hoffa's orders, this car bomb?
Well, I think it's...
At least his group.
To this day, it's still debated about whether it
he
was
gave
Hoffa,
the order.
Or it was the Teamsters themselves blowing up their own car to make it look like Hoffa blew up the car to fast track the murder.
Well,
I believe it was Hoffa. I don't believe
it would have to, because why would the mob like possibly take out innocent people,
right,
at a pretty named place, and then you got everybody on your head?
Because if this was in response to one of Hoffa's close allies, a guy named Dave Johnston, who was a big Teamster, he had his boat blown up and Groziel.
Scott Bernstein, I told you, he's the country's greatest true crime writer. This motherfucker is deep, and a board member of the Mob Museum in Vegas, which, by the way, is the second biggest attraction
in Nevada right now
after Hoover Dam.
It's crazy.
Can you believe
what
that?
It's become in the last decade? Yeah.
You guys got slot machines in that?
They
museum?
Do. And they got a speakeasy, like an old school speakeasy.
Don't grow up with the speakeasy. give me the password, bro.
So you need a password.
What's the
again?
Password, bro?
So
come on, give me, who killed Hoffa and what's the password?
July 10th.
July 10th. So I go to the museum.
That,
and
you just tell them July 10th, 1975. Firebombing at Nemo's. So in that
quite a long password.
In the next 20 days, the decision is made to kill him, and the.
Okay, so the decision's made.
July 10th, the firebombing at Nemo's.
A lunch is arranged. Is there, what's going on at the Red Fox? I mean, was it a let's get together and calm shit down?
So in the next 20 days, the commission, which is the board of directors of the mafia, which Detroit had a seat on, which was rare, not a lot of cities outside of New York had representation
Buffalo
on the
did,
commission.
Chicago did.
Buffalo did. Chicago
Kansas
did.
Kansas City did. Detroit?
No, Kansas City did not.
They did not. Satellite is Chicago.
Philadelphia, Detroit, Buffalo, Chicago.
Okay.
Were the non-New York cities that had seats on the commission. Cleveland, Kansas City, Milwaukee were spoken for by Detroit and Chicago. They represented the other Midwest families. So the decision's made. The contract is given to Detroit because Hoffa is a Detroit asset, was cultivated by Detroit, managed by Detroit. So Detroit, it's like basically you brought him in, you take him out. And the Giacalone brothers are given the contract. Now, the bosses of the mob in Detroit have always been the Tocco Zarillis. They're royalty. They're an aristocracy.
I used to deliver flowers to them.
But they weren't. They were very polished, college educated. The Giacalones were the junkyard dogs. The Giacalones were the guys that did all the dirty work, the blue collar wing of the family. the ones that got a lot of the headlines and kind of acted as a lightning rod for the aristocracy. So Anthony Tony Jack Jackalone and his younger brother Vito Billy Jack Jackalone. So if you were, you know, a Detroiter in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, those names were in the news a lot. And the FBI suspects the Jackalone brothers, this is not an exaggeration, the FBI suspects the Jackalone brothers of committing somewhere between 50 to 100 murders. So, I mean, these were serial killers, you know, sociopaths. And they were Hoffa's longtime conduit to the union. So they were the ones that were going to arrange for his murder. They went up, and Hoffa at that point was living in Lake Orion, living at his lake cottage.
Up near Oakland Township.
Right where you get off for what is today the Great Lakes Crossing, the Jocelyn exit. And then you go about less than a mile north and you hit his property. And the Jackalones were up there on July 27th. So 3 days before, they were up there and they explained to him, listen, Jimmy, we're going to help you get the union back. Now, this was all a ruse, but this was the way to get. They knew the only way they were really going to get him out in the open was
to let him know it was safe.
To let him know it was safe was to tell him what he wanted to hear.
Right.
Which was, hey, we're going to make all your problems go away. We're your friends. We're going to do what you need us to do to get your union back. And the way you're going to get the union back is you're going to squash your beef with Tony Provenzano, who was a New Jersey mobster, ran all of the Teamsters action on the East Coast, controlled all those delegates. So Hoffa did need Provenzano's sign off to get those delegates right for the 76th election. Provenzano and Hoffa used to be very, very close friends. And they had a huge falling out when they were in prison. And throughout the 1970s, up until Hoffa's disappearance, they were bitter enemies, threatening to kill each other and kill each other's families. I mean, that's how bad it got. And so the Jackalones came to him and said, listen, Tony Provenzano has agreed to mend fences with you. And, oh, by the way, next week, Bill Buffalino is marrying off his daughter. So there's going to be a mob wedding with mafia luminaries from around the country are going to be coming into Detroit this week. So we're going to have Tony Pro come in a couple days early and we're going to have this meeting. And in the meeting, you're going to say, I'm sorry, Tony. And Tony's going to say, I'm sorry, Jimmy. You're going to shake hands and you're going to be back on track to take over the Teamsters Union. So the meeting was supposed to be at the Maccas Red Fox. It was supposed to be Tony Jackalone, Tony Provenzano, and Lenny Schultz, who was a Jewish racketeer, traces his roots all the way back to the Purple Gang, became a right hand for Tony Jackalone and owned the Southland Athletic Club, which was Tony Jackalone's daily headquarters, which was in the Travelers Towers. Travelers Towers still exists today, on right off of 696, 11 and Evergreen.
Okay.
Southfield. Yeah. I believe it was Bally. It was Fox Sports, which then became Bally Sports.
What are you, a fucking real estate agent? Come on, guys. Let's move along here. So what's up with the lunch here? Who's supposed to be at the lunch?
So they're supposed to be at the lunch. Is Lenny Schultz, Tony Pro, and Tony Jack. Hoffa, Hoffa had a photo shoot the morning that he disappeared. And there's a famous photo of him kind of looking off into the water with kind of his hands on his knees. And it's a photo that's been used countless times. That photo was snapped hours before he got killed. So he does a photo shoot. He goes to the meeting. It's supposed to take place at 2 o'clock. Shows up at the Maccas Red Fox at 15 and Telegraph in Bloomfield Township. And nobody's there. And he sits for about a half hour, 40 minutes. He thinks he's been stood up. He leaves the Red Fox. He goes to the Bloomfield Shopping Plaza, which is Red Fox, which is now Andiamo, sits in the parking lot of the Bloomfield Plaza shopping mall. Hoffa goes to a payphone, calls his wife, says, there is no meeting. They ditched it. I'm going to go pick up some steaks at the grocery store. I'm going to come home. I'm going to grill steaks for dinner. As he's headed back to his car to leave, he's intercepted by a 1975 maroon-colored Mercury Marquis. It was a car that was owned by Joey Jackalone, Tony Jackalone's youngest son. And Hoffa is coerced into the car, and they go off onto Telegraph Road, and nobody ever sees Jimmy Hoffa again.
Which leads us to Macomb County Community College, July 23rd. One more time.
July 23rd, Macomb Community College, the South Campus at 12 and Hayes, 7 to 9. We're going to do an hour and a half of a multimedia event presentation, half hour of question and answers. You can go to ogmediaevents.com. It's $30 a ticket. You can come in. You can, you know, hitch a ride to learning about parts of history that nobody has really ever been privy to. And we're going to be really kind of wrapping this up and putting a bow on it. Whether the FBI decides to close down the investigation in a couple weeks or not, I don't know.
Let's see what you got.
But I'm eager
it's
to
exciting.
Kind of, after 50 years, kind of say, hey, listen, the three of us come from, you know, three different angles on this. We all agree that this is what happened.
And we want to share it. And here are the receipts.
Yeah.
Fascinating, man. Listen, didn't you used to cover high school football for like...
I did a lot of... So I wrote my first book, and it came out in 2007, and I've written five since then. But yes, I moonlighted doing football recruiting, football and basketball college recruiting.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I'm proud of you, man.
Thank you. And now I'm kind of my own... Like I said, I was inspired by you, kind of my own brand. Check out Original Gangsters Podcast on YouTube. We're well over 10 million imprints, and we have listeners and viewers from I think 5 of 7 continents, and we're real proud of what we're doing over there.
And one minute only. P. Diddy's Detroit connections, go.
Well, there would be no Bad Boy Records if it wasn't for Detroit's Black Mafia family, BMF. There's a show on Starz right now. I've worked on it for the last 5 years. Shout out to Starz and G-Unit and 50 Cent. Go check out that show. Black Mafia family back in 1993 seeded Bad Boy Records with an investment. The head of security for Bad Boy Records was a Black Mafia family lieutenant named Uncle Paulie Buford, whose name has come up in the racketeering trial. He threatened to throw P. Diddy's personal assistant into the East River if she didn't divulge her knowledge of a theft of Puffy's jewelry. And then Cassie, who was Puffy's punching bag for a decade, she's now married and has three kids with a guy from Lake Orion.
So I don't know if that was a meme Mark just put up.
It broke while we were on.
So it broke. It says Diddy gets off. I just thought that was a meme, but
that's from the New York Post today.
So
he's
Diddy acquitted on top charges in bombshell sex trafficking case, found guilty only of prostitution.
Yep. Charges 3 and 5.
They overcharged.
Apparently. Yeah. All right.
Pretty wild.
Scott Bernstein, well, I'm see you on the 23rd.
Thank you, sir.
Before we go,
and then my daily reporting is on my web magazine, Gangster Report, www.gangsterreport.com. And we cover real-time organized crime around the country, whether it be Italian mobsters, biker bosses, and drug dealers.
Let me give you this.
Yeah.
In honor of 4th of July in the service of the founding and the maintenance of this great country is my own family, my daughter's grandfather's through the centuries. 265 years ago, Charles Leglon, the commander of the Indian force in the French and Indian War at the Battle of Montreal, 1760. It was written, his actions that day. Leglon, the Indians, and most of the militia took cover in the trees and bushes on the front of the left flank of the British army. From the protection of this cover, they threw a telling fire at the assembled troops. Outnumbered 10 to 1, by the way. Although the British soldiers absorbed terrible losses, they kept their ranks and held their fire until the French regulars approached. During the battle, Leglon fought bravely, and later, Amabel Daguerre, one of his companions, described Leglon's behavior during the battle as such. He never saw so perfectly cool and fearless a man on the field of battle. When his gun barrel had got so hot from repeated and rapid discharges, he took the occasion to stop a little while that it might cool. When he would draw his pipe from his pouch, cut his tobacco, fill his pipe, take a piece of punk wood and strike fire with his steel and flint and light and smoke his pipe, all with as much sang-froid as at his own fireside. And having cooled his gun and refreshed himself, would resume his place and play well his part in the battle. Despite the bravery, Leglon and his companions, the order and discipline of the French regulars prevailed, and the tide of the battle soon became apparent. The French lines, filled in part by Canadians, unaccustomed to open field warfare, soon broke rank and started to run away. Canadians ran away on my grandfather.
Is this him right there? Because he kind of looks just like you.
Yeah, that is.
That is him,
that would
right?
be my grandfather, Charles Leglon. Considered the grandfather of Wisconsin.
That's
born in Mackinac Island.
That's
became the commandant there. Okay, speaking of commandant, Mackinac Island would be my grandfather, William Marshall. 140 years ago, he made the front page of the New York Times and on his death in 1884. I wish to honor my grandfather, Ordnance Sergeant William Marshall. He served from 1823 until his death in 1884. At 84 years old, Marshall is the oldest active serviceman in the history of the United States, as far as my research goes. His legacy has never been acknowledged. I hope that it shall someday, and sincere thanks to all who have served. And finally, 60 years ago, my father, my daughter's grandfather, his name is Royal Charles LaDuff. He served in Nam, never talked much about it, but before he passed, he sent me a jumbled bag of bars and ribbons. That's his expeditionary medal. When Pops got home to Detroit, he drove a truck for Wonder Bread for a bit. Recalling the troubles of 68, my father told me, son, the bread truck don't show up in a riot or a war. It's worth remembering, my friends. Happy birthday, United States. Keep it together. And again, thank you all for your service. Scott Bernstein, love you, brother.
Thank you, man. For real.